When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
We want the truth, so watch Truth Wanted live Fridays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/yttw and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/calltw.
Everybody, how we doing? I'm Matt Dillahunty. Welcome to the Atheist Experience. We are live. It is Sunday, September 25th, 2022. Joining me this week, Andrew Seidel. How are you, sir?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
I'm tired, but I'm good. I can't imagine I'm anywhere near as tired as you. You've been running around like wild lately, haven't you?
Yeah. I got a new book coming out, so life is a little insane at the moment.
Imagine that. Andrew has a new book, and then he comes on the Atheist Experience to talk about stuff and take calls. I wish you were here. I really do.
I do, too.
We're doing so cool. They've done a lot of work down here in the studio. I got air conditioning pointed at me that's like, ooh.
Oh, that's new.
Yeah, it's Texas, so it's like essential. I should have put it in a contract somewhere, except I don't have a contract. On that note, we have callers lined up, and when we're in between calls and as people call in, Andrew, give everybody the name of your latest book here.
The latest book is American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. It is all about the push to turn our First Amendment and that hallowed protection of freedom of religion into a weapon, a tool to impose conservative Christianity on the entire country. And it's pretty damn alarming, I gotta say.
Yeah. So any of you who have questions on separation of religion and government, church-state separation issues, things like that, get your calls in. The phones are live now, and we have calls that are ready to go here. Oh, I lost the one that I was going to take. Doesn't matter. Dustin in Texas, pronouns are he, him. Welcome, Dustin. How are you, sir?
Matt, hi. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Excellent. And Andrew, hi. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Dustin?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
What have you got for us today?
Well, first, before I get to the topic, Matt, real quick, I saw you in person in Washington, D.C. area in 2018 at your Skeptic show.
Yeah.
And I think I owe you an apology.
Well,
I told you when I got to meet you at the end of the show, keep doing what you're doing. And I just think that's not the right thing to say, because who am I to tell you what to do or not to do? So instead, I want to say thank you for what you're doing. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. No apology necessary. Let's get on with the show. We can have a drink sometime and argue semantics on how to say thanks. But I appreciate being appreciated, and thanks for saying so.
Excellent. And I would love that sometime. Okay, to the topic. I've been an agnostic for quite a while, and I've actually heard you talk about agnostics a lot and about how you really can't be one. And I kind of get it now. So I absolutely have no proof for God or no proof against God. I know I don't know. But in the past 2.5 years or so, I've actually come to the idea that I've choose to believe in God. And in doing so, I feel like my life has gotten better. And I just wanted to see what you had to say about that.
So first of all, I don't know what you think you've heard me say about agnostics, but depending on the definitions and usage, I am agnostic. So it's not an issue if I can't be one.
Right.
But when you say you just choose to believe in God, really? Uh-huh. I'm not convinced I can do that. I'm not convinced anybody can do that. Because when you believe something, that means you accept that it's true, and that's the result of becoming convinced. You can't just say, I choose to believe that the sky is on fire, unless there's some reason for it.
But
You can choose to act like you believe.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you can act like you believe there is no God when there is one. We don't know, right?
What I'm saying is that I don't see belief as a choice. Can you choose to believe that you have $23 billion in a savings account?
But I know, as the truth is, that I don't have
$23 billion. No, you don't. I ask specific questions for a reason. Can you choose to believe? What if I told you that I had set up an account for you with this guy I know, and he set it up for you, and he put $23 billion in there? Can you just choose to believe that?
Well, what I would do, like every human, I would say, okay, show me and prove it. And then that would be either it's there or it's not.
Okay, so back to the question that I've asked. Can you just choose to believe it?
If I absolutely don't know it and can't prove it, yes, absolutely, I can choose to believe it.
I completely disagree. I do not see belief.
Why?
In that, I don't see how it's possible. You can choose to act like you believe, but belief means you are convinced, not just you're going to pretend to be convinced, or you're going to act like you're convinced, or you wish you were convinced, or you're going to pretend. Belief is the result of being convinced. Where are you at, Andrew?
I mean, I think I'm in the same place as you, Matt. I mean, Dustin, I'm trying to envision the actual moment where you said this to yourself, and I can't picture it. You know what I mean? Like you agree there's no evidence, but you think you know you can't know, so you just say, okay, I believe there's a God. Like, how did that actually play that out for me? Do a real replay for me.
Real replay. So
yeah,
when there's no proof for, but there is absolutely no proof against either. Zero proof against whether or not there's a God. We all.
I get your setup, but like, how did that actually work in your brain?
In my brain, it hit me that what if God created us not to know on purpose?
And okay, what if He didn't?
What if He didn't? But you get to choose to believe if He did or didn't.
You don't get to choose.
Why not?
I mean, you're free to choose, but choosing, you can choose to say that you're convinced. You can choose to act like you're convinced, but that doesn't mean you're convinced. Becoming convinced of something isn't an act of volition. You have no control over what you are convinced about.
Dustin, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sensing where you were going with that is a little bit of reverse engineering, is a term I use for the Supreme Court when they have a conclusion that they want to get to, and then they reverse engineer the rationale. And it sounds to me like that is what I just heard you say you did. Like, you wanted to get to, okay, this is now a reason I can believe in God. Is that incorrect?
Exactly. Yes. No, that's correct. It is. Okay. It's like I've always wanted there to be God, but never had a reason to actually believe, especially in some of the religions today. I'm not going to even go there.
How do you know?
I don't believe in them.
How do you know that you're not engaged in self-deception then? Because you admit that you wanted there to be a God. You don't have evidence for it. You're convinced there's not evidence against it. So now you're just saying that you choose to believe. But that's not belief.
Right.
That's choosing to act as if you believe. That's choosing to say, I really want this to be. How many other things in your life do you want to be true? And then you just say, okay, I'm going to believe it. I want to believe that I have 25 people who love me and owe me money. I want to believe that this guy is red.
You're giving all these other reasons. I'm just talking about God. No,
and I'm talking about epistemology. This is the part here. I don't care that you're just talking about God. The point is, move it away from God, because the issue here is, what is belief? How do you become convinced? And you don't get to claim that there's a special set of convincing for God and not for other things. So when you dismiss that and say, I'm only talking about God, not these other things, what you're doing is lying about what you are convinced of. Because epistemology doesn't care what the subject is. Your brain doesn't matter if it's a God claim or a money claim or whatever else. You are either convinced by evidence or you're not. Why are you trying to engage in special pleading to pretend like the thing you want to be true is believable when it's not?
Well, that's the phrase I was going to use too, actually, special pleading. That's exactly what it sounds like. That hypothesis ought to be treated no differently than any other you have. So why, Dustin, are you treating it differently, at least in your own head?
Okay, so you guys are saying it's being treated differently, but why do you think it's any different from an atheist choosing not to believe in God?
Atheists don't choose to believe in God. I didn't choose to not believe. I am not convinced. Just like I didn't choose to not believe that I'm a billionaire, I didn't choose to not believe that I got a you know, that I'm the best looking person on the planet. I didn't choose to not believe any of those things. I'm just not convinced of the claim. Propositional logic relies on a claim. And it's not just a question of, oh, it could be this or this. I'll just pick either one. It is an assertion that X is true, and you either accept that X is true or you don't accept that X is true. And for the claim, some God exists, I don't accept that it's true. I am not convinced.
But Dustin, why did you want to believe that there is a God?
Oh, well, I want to believe there is a God. It's like the idea of the, if there is a God, then that means there's more than just nothingness. Like there's like a something more behind the scenes. There's more than just what it seems on the surface. And in believing in God, it can kind of give a lot more life to this life.
That makes no sense to me. That makes literally. I also, that is the most sophistry nonsense thing I've ever heard. It gives more life to this life
backwards.
Thing.
I think that's backwards.
Yeah.
I think that's backwards. Being human is hard, but it's also an adventure. And to say that there is an end to my existence is to concentrate the sweetness of everything, every moment that we do have here. Because that which is rare is valuable, and that which is eternal is banal. You know, we're on this tiny outpost, the mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam, for that fleeting moment, for barely a blink. And it's up to us to endow that time with meaning and purpose. It's up to you, Dustin. To say that there's no God, as I do, is not to say that there's no meaning. It's to say that we give life meaning and purpose. You can try to do good and to practice empathy and to lead the world to a better place. Facing reality, embracing reality, isn't a necessary first step, but it's a damn good place to start, my friend.
Yeah, and attached to that, and I'll let you continue here in just a second, Dustin. Attached to that is when you say you want there to be a God because it adds more life to life, what you're also saying is all of us who don't believe in God are somehow deficient in life.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that life could be
then
better.
Then prove it. Then prove it. I know you've chosen to believe that all the rest of us are deficient in life, but I don't buy that bullshit. So prove that I am deficient in life.
It's not that you like your life is bad, or I'm just saying it could be better. I'm just saying.
And I'm saying prove it. Why is it that I keep asking very specific questions and you avoid them? Prove that my life could be better.
By being grateful without God, you don't need God in this. By being grateful, does it make your life better?
I didn't say anything about. I have no opposition to being grateful. Are you going to argue honestly, okay, or are you just going to keep coming up with irrelevant things? Do you think for a second that I don't that I'm not grateful, that I don't appreciate things?
I mean, Dustin, look.
I stepped on you. Go ahead.
It's comforting sometimes to think there's an all-powerful, all-knowing God that has a plan for you. It's comforting to think there's a God that loves you, that loves us, except that you have, but think about what you have to ignore. Think about what you have to ignore to have that, to ignore the suffering and childhood cancer and hunger. God's plan's comforting, but people pray it away and try to change his mind. It's comforting, except that if you're in the wrong sect, you're going to go to hell for eternal torture. It's comforting to be certain, except that you're not. And you've essentially said that a couple times. Not really, right? You've got doubts. You don't know. And you just ignore them as God ignores those kids who are dying of hunger, right? Those doubts are the truth knocking at your brain, saying, why are you pretending to be sure about this thing for which you have no evidence and doesn't actually make sense to us? Is it just because other people told you to? So look, certainty is not truth, and comfort is not truth. And it's scarier to think that the universe doesn't care about what happens to you. It doesn't, but other people do. We give life meaning.
So yeah, I don't believe any of those things that you said about the suffering and the doubts. I created my own God. I don't believe in Christianity or any of those other gods.
Well, why? So you have a God that you're the only person in the world that believes in?
Probably.
Okay, so you have a God that you're the only person on the planet who believes in it, and you acknowledge that you can't demonstrate the truth of it, and you're just going to run asserting that you wanted it to be true, and that you like the idea that you think you have a more valuable life than those of us who don't believe that. I have zero interest in anything else from you, because basically what you're saying is I made some shit up because it makes me feel better and it makes me feel like I'm better than you. Well, why would I want to talk to somebody who thinks that?
Oh, I never think I'm better than you.
You said that God adds to your life and that my life could be better. And when I asked you to prove that my life could be better, you ran away. Can my life be better or not? And can you prove it?
Yes.
Prove it.
Absolutely. I tried to talk to you.
Prove it.
Being grateful to things makes your life better.
Listen, jackass, if you bring up grateful again, I'm going to hang up on you, because I have no objection to being grateful. I have objection to a God.
What is your objection to a God?
I don't have any reason to believe that a God exists. I have a reason to believe that gratitude is good and useful. I engage in it, as do the people around me. Why are you talking about gratitude? Is your God just gratitude?
My God consists of gratitude and forgiveness and love. Yeah.
That's not a God. Those are things that we do. We engage in gratitude. We engage in forgiveness. We engage in love. None of those things require a thinking agent or anything that would be qualified as a God under any normative definition.
They do not acquire.
No, wait. And those are things that we do for and to each other as well, Dustin.
Yep.
That's shared humanity that you're talking about.
If every human being existed, there would be no gratitude or love, or if every thinking being in the universe existed, there'd be no gratitude, love, or whatever.
Oh, why not? Prove that.
Because there's no thinking minds for that. All of those things require a thinking mind.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
And Dustin, the point that I'm trying to make when I say that that's our shared humanity is that I think you're denigrating that shared humanity a little bit by attributing those very human instincts and emotions to something divine that is specific to you. And I'd encourage you to really, really dig down and rethink that and really do some self-examination on that particular belief.
But also the God that you're advocating for, if it's only you, congrats. That's a useless God proposition that has no, I mean, it's not even worth wasting time talking about.
Well, I don't want it to be only for me. That's the whole reason I'm calling in.
Well, then prove that it's real and it might be for somebody else. But until then, it's just for people who are gullible and confused.
And people who want it, yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Dustin.
Yeah, thank you, guys. You guys have a good one.
Yeah.
Bye.
All right. I'm in the building here at the Atheist Community of Austin Freethought Library. Andrew is not in the building.
I'm not.
He just had to be somewhere else. Here at the building, we won't be in the building every single week, but we will be back in the building October 30th, and actually slightly before then, because on the 27th, we'll be live for Secular Sexuality on that Thursday. On the 28th, it'll be Truth Wanted. And then on the 30th, it'll be Talk Heathen, an Atheist Experience. If you are in the Austin area or plan to be in the Austin area on the weekend of October 30th, consider making plans to join us at the Freethought Library. Doors open at noon on Sunday for Talk Heathen at 1 and AXP at 4:30. Parking is wherever you can find a legal spot after the building lot is filled up. And if you can't make it on October 30th, we'll continue over the current plan right now. Their schedule is for the last Sunday of each month. Keep watching our shows and the Atheist Community of Austin website for more information about that. If you're watching us right now, I can't see. Normally I'm at home and I have like a YouTube thing up and I can't watch chat. They've almost got me handcuffed here. I'm stuck. But no, if you're watching here, we really appreciate you guys watching. And there is merch available. If you want to contribute, there's a contribute button below there. But you can also go to tiny.cc/merch/ACA to find that merchandise as well. And if you are someone who shops on Amazon, you can support the Atheist Community of Austin at no cost to yourself. Simply go to tiny.cc/Amazon. Smile. I mistyped it as Amaxon, so I added an X in there. Amazon Smile, and designate the Atheist Community of Austin as your selected charity, and Amazon will donate a portion of their profits to the ACA. You can also become a member of the organization on YouTube, which gets you out of slow mode and a number of other things. There's also patreon.com/theatheistexperience. And if you like having conversations, or if you want to try out your conversations on atheists before you jump in and are potentially under fire on a show, there's a number of unofficial forums that we've been promoting here, including the Atheist Experience fan group and the Atheist Experience private fan group. They're tiny.cc/FBAXPPR there for the last one. And then there's the Atheist Community of Austin website, www.atheist-community.org. You can go there for news, information, updates. And any of your feedback, questions, concerns, criticisms, etc., can go to tv@atheist-community.org. I'm told that we have an audience question here ready to go, so welcome. Who have we got?
I'm Jamie.
Hey, Jamie.
I'm here in...
Hi, Jamie.
England, but I'm from... Now, quick bit of background. I used to call myself an agnostic. I'm now an atheist. And part of that came from an experience I had at a comedy show where the comedian asked the audience, who here is agnostic? I put my hand up and he called me a fence-sitting bisexual bastard.
Wait, he called you a fence-sitting bisexual bastard?
Which
isn't that like the definition of fence setting, to be bisexual?
Yeah, because he was conveying to me that he felt that agnosticism was sitting on the fence, not having a strong position.
Yeah.
And while I was hurt and offended by it, I it was one step of the journey for me to crystallize and become more certain in my position as an atheist, which I'm very staunch now. So my questions are, one, do you think that was a good thing for him to do or a good experience to have? And two, do you believe that people who believe in irrational things like a god or spirits or nymphs or djinn, is offense getting over offense and dealing with offense something that they have a necessity to get through, they have to go through?
Andrew, what do you think? Was it a good thing for them to call him a fence-sitting bisexual bastard?
I think djinn is very real, but I think you were saying
D-J-I-N-N.
Other than that, this, I mean, I don't know the context, and it's a comedy show, and maybe he mocked every audience member. I'm generally not a fan of that. I'm not a fan of making fun of people for their beliefs or singling somebody out in a crowd. I mean, I've dedicated my whole career to standing up to bullies wielding power in ways that I'm not a fan of. That's certainly not my cup of tea, and I don't know that it is. I know that it's not necessary to offend people to drive them out of their current belief system. I mean that's ludicrous to me, that idea. There have been so many. I'm hesitating because I don't have any data. That's all anecdotal. But I know so many people who have deconstructed their faith and have done so after long, thoughtful nights and trips to the library and armfuls of books and reading that didn't require mocking to drive them away. So no, I'm not a fan of that. Whether or not they need to overcome offense, I think a lot of people are hurt by the fact that they feel lied to when they are deconstructing their faith. They have been lied to, and in kind of awful ways, often as they were children, by people who they trusted. So I don't know if it's necessarily offense or if it's more betrayal, but I do think there can certainly be a lot of emotions tied up with deconstructing one's faith. And let me say, too, I've never had to do that. I was fortunate enough to not be raised in a very strict anything household. My mom encouraged me to go out and go to a temple with my Jewish friends and mass with my Catholic friends. Apparently, after my first bar mitzvah, I came home and said I wanted to be Jewish because it was the best party that I'd ever been to. And for me, it became very clear early on that the truth claims were mutually exclusive. And the more likely thing was that nobody had it right. And I truly am astounded. And I truly mean this, by people who have the intellectual honesty and fortitude to question those deeply held beliefs. Then they've been told by the people they trust and love that these are true, and they are the most important beliefs you can ever have. And if you don't think they're true, you're gonna be in serious trouble for all eternity. I think it is remarkable that people have the intellectual courage and fortitude to look at those beliefs and deconstruct them and come out the other side non-believing. That to me is just absolutely amazing, and I stand in awe of anybody who has done that. You have my amazement and my total empathy.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't mind if, like, in a comedy setting, somebody good-natured jabs. If it turned out that it kind of prompted you to go down a path that was ultimately positive, then I'm not too worried about it. I agree with Andrew. This is not necessary to offend in all cases, but it may be necessary to shock some people. Like, I remember plenty of people we've talked to over the years, and even me in the past, if you aren't presented with the notion that disbelief is a thing or an identity, or that you have the ability to evaluate these things and say, oh yes, I'm an atheist or whatever, shocking people into being aware of those possibilities is probably a good thing. But I, despite the fact that I know I offend mountains of people, my goal is not to offend people. But if you're offended by someone telling you the truth, well, then I'm not your cup of tea, because I'm always going to tell you what I think. It's just that I don't think that people who are agnostic are actually fence sitters, because I don't see agnosticism as some halfway point where you can tip. To me, theism and atheism are about belief. Gnosticism and agnosticism are about knowledge. Knowledge is a subset of belief. A billion times I've probably said that now. But it's not a fence-sitting thing. I do find that there are a number of people who smugly identify as agnostic as a way of avoiding either identifying as a theist or as an atheist. And they'll be like, oh, it's the ones that are like, both sides are, just as bad. You're just as bad as a fundamentalist. Really? I don't have any dogma. I'm not trying to tell other people how to live their life. I'm just exposing lies and fallacious arguments.
Can I just interject one thing there too, Matt?
Sure.
Because that's prizing balance over truth. And that is one of the biggest problems that we have with our media today, is they prize balance over truth. And instead of, you know, calling fascism fascism, they react and clutch their pearls when somebody does do that. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. You can continue. I apologize.
Yeah, it's fine. On that note, we're going to move on. We got another caller. We actually have bunches of callers waiting, but this one's special. Thomas is calling in from Kentucky, pronouns are he, him, and wants to ask you, Andrew, in what way does the Supreme Court weaponize religious freedom? But I'll let him ask that. So welcome, Thomas.
Okay. Hi, Matt. Hi, Andrew.
How you doing?
Hi.
So I'm doing good. First, I just want to say, Matt, it was actually you and Jeff D from an old YouTube video on the Atheist Experience that deconverted me from Christianity, and I became an atheist after watching one of those videos. So
thank you so much for saying so.
Thank you. No problem. Anyways, yeah, I seen there was a topic that was in the live chat. It was a question that says, do you think the Supreme Court is weaponizing religious freedoms? And I'm unfamiliar. In what way are they weaponizing religious freedoms?
Thomas, I'm so glad you asked that. I have a new book out called American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. And religious freedom has long been a shield, right? It has been this hallowed protection, something that guards all of us against government overreach. It often protects the minority from the tyranny of the majority. And it's a right that we possess equally, and which helps ensure that equality that we believe should be one of America's founding principles and have been fighting to realize for a couple centuries now, right? So religious freedom embodies those words that are etched into the edifice of the Supreme Court, equal justice under law. And it is supported by a strong separation of church and state. In fact, you cannot have religious freedom without a separation of church and state. But not anymore. None of that is true anymore. And that's because there is a well-funded, powerful network of Christian nationalist organizations and judges, a billion-dollar shadow network that has been working to weaponize the First Amendment, to turn the protection of religious freedom that's enjoyed by all into a weapon of privilege for the few. And this network of faithful and well-funded activist groups, we're going to call them crusaders, that's what I call them in the book, together with conservative justices on the Supreme Court, launched this crusade to weaponize religious freedom. And it really is a war of conquest, not of land. The crusaders are looking to conquer our Constitution and to remake it in their image. They are setting out to make America a Christian nation and warping religious freedom as an attempt to bring us all under their yoke, their rule. So if you look at some of the religious freedom challenges that have been brought before this court recently, they are superficially about coaches or Christian crosses and veterans or playgrounds and skinned knees or private school vouchers or bakeries and gay weddings. But really, they're about religious privilege, literally about privileging religion over non-religion and the right kind of conservative Christian over everybody else. The goal is literally to elevate conservative Christianity above the law, to exempt conservative Christians from the law while disfavoring non-religious and non-Christian citizens who are then required to follow the law. They want a weapon to codify their privilege and supremacy, and that weapon is religious freedom. Okay.
Wow.
I think I convinced Thomas. I can keep going.
Thomas is stunned and doesn't even have the book yet.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it sounds like what you were saying is a lot of things that the Satanic Temple is fighting against. They're advocating women's rights and religious freedoms, and there's a lot of hypocrisy done by the conservative right in terms of not being fair to everybody with religious freedoms. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with when the Ten Commandments statue was erected in, I think, Arkansas. And I believe there was a Republican senator there that said there will never be a satanic Baphomet that's going to be erected right next to that. They're favoring one religion and they're basically saying to hell with the rest. I mean, that's not really fair and equal, in my opinion.
No, it's absolutely not. And I helped craft the lawsuit against that Ten Commandments monument that Jason Raper put up in Arkansas and a couple others as well in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So, I mean, but that is the goal, right? The goal is to elevate conservative Christianity above the law. And it really is. The weapon that they're creating out of religious freedom really is exclusive, right? Again, we think of it as something that enshrines equality. That's what you're talking about. The Satanic Temple can come in and it can put up its own monument. No, because this is their weapon, not ours. You only get to wield the weapon if you are the right kind of religion. Again, right in scare quotes, if you're a conservative Christian. And the point is to reclaim the privilege that this dwindling minority had in the face of equality and demographic change, right? So that this is the story that I tell in American Crusade, how the Supreme Court is weaponizing religious freedom, this decades-long campaign. And I genuinely do not think you can understand what is happening in this country right now, from our politics to our culture to our law and our courts, without understanding this attack. That's why, I mean, this is why I wrote American Crusade. So what I actually do in the book is tell the stories behind the Supreme Court cases that make up this attack. I draw back the curtain on the assault because, you know, sometimes we legal professionals get buried under legalese and civil procedure and judicial philosophies and levels of scrutiny and precedents. And sometimes we hide behind those things. It's often better to just cut through all that bullshit that lawyers and judges build up around their profession. And American Crusade does just that. I wrote this for everybody so that you can pick this book up and understand what a very serious threat we face right now.
I agree. And
you agree you're going to pick up a copy, Thomas? That sounds like a good idea, my friend.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to pick up a copy. If he was here right now, I'd pick up one right now and have him sign it. Thanks so much for the call, Thomas. I appreciate it. And for everybody else who's out there, not only can you pick up Andrew's book, but we're going to talk a little bit in between some other calls as people get questions. When people ask me, what can we do? What can we do to fight back against this, you know, this crusade, the Supreme Court and everything else? And I'm as involved as I can be. And apart from, you know, vote, speak up, vote, speak up, vote, speak up, I run out of things. Are there more practical solutions that you're advocating in the book and elsewhere, apart from just voting and speaking up?
There are quite a few things you can do. I mean, and I think one thing I always tell people is you have to temper your expectations. And I've had to say this, I think, in every public appearance I've made since the Supreme Court's absurd term ended in June. You have to temper your, everybody wants this silver bullet where we can fix everything like that. And that does not exist right now. There's something that's close, but it's still going to take a while. I mean, temper your expectations on what it is going to take to undo the damage that has already been done by this crusade and how we're going to then also repair the damage that's been done, right? I mean, there's a lot of work to do here, and it is not simply a matter of voting. A lot, you know, I think we often think we treat voting like it is, Stacey Abrams likes to say, like a magic wand. And it's not, it's medicine. You have to take it all the time. That's her line. I like to say that voting is literally the least you can do. Like voting is literally the least you can do. If you are not doing a lot more than that, you should not expect to see a change. Voting gives us a chance to possibly maybe make a change. It is not the be all end all. And in a world of immediate gratification, we put way too much stock in it. You have to vote. It's a duty. It's literally the least you can do. I also would encourage everybody to go out and join the groups that have been on the forefront of fighting for this. We need absolutely all the help you can get. Join Americans United for Separation of Church and State. That's who I work for. It's a nonpartisan, non-for-profit educational advocacy organization. It brings together people of all religions and of none to protect the right of everybody to believe as they want and to stop, and this is the important part, anyone from using their beliefs to harm others. And AU's been fighting in the courts, in the legislatures, and in the public square for freedom without favor and equality without exception for 75 years. It's doing some really amazing work on the long game, that long-term fight that we have. And I really believe that they are on the forefront of this. That's a couple things. Join some of the other groups too, American Atheist, American Humanist Association, all doing amazing work. Of course, you can buy the book. And listen, somebody actually signed a bunch of these today at my local bookstore. If anybody wants a signed copy, you go to bit.ly/signedAC. My local bookstore will handle the order. And then I go in and I sign the books, and I was in there today. And whatever you do, don't do this. But somebody did. Somebody bought a copy for Greg Locke. I know you know who he is, Matt.
Yeah.
In Tennessee.
Is he ready to burn it?
I think that was what this kind-hearted person did. They bought a copy for Greg Locke and told me to sign it however I saw fit. So Greg Locke is getting a copy of my new book, courtesy of an admirer. So whatever you do, do not do that, though. Yeah. I much prefer you read it rather than him burn it.
It's really interesting because, you know, while I know who Locke is and he's a terrible hate-mongering preacher guy, I think more people know about who he is because he burned your book as a stunt than anything he's said or done actually about Jesus.
I think that's probably true. And then he started capitalizing on COVID and then Roger Stone and all that fun stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, it is wild watching a lot of this stuff. By the way, for all of you who are tuning in, if you like to engage in discussions, there's the Atheist versus Theist Debates group, which will appear up on the screen right there. You can go there, and that's a good place to start on some of these things so that you can get your A game put together. But all, you know, if you're a theist calling in, but also if you're an atheist, if you're not familiar with the various arguments that are out there, and there's people who can help out with that. You can also, I know Talk Heathen was live earlier here in the building today, and we're here for Atheist Experience, but in the gap between there, there's a new episode of Nonprofits that airs at 3 p.m. Yes, Johnny, Nonprofits, the flagship show of the atheist community of Austin. It's like I lost a bet every time I have to say that. But you can also go to tiny.cc/AENpodcasts. That is your one-stop shop for audio versions of all of the ACA shows, Secular Sexuality, Truth Wanted, Talk Heathen, Atheist Experience. You can get it all there. And it's time to thank our wonderful crew. Please put yourselves up on the screen and wave. Look at him back there in the studio, like... so well trained, pushing those buttons to make things work in ways that I'll never understand. But and in addition to the people that you saw, there are also moderators. There are people who are screening calls, taking notes, and putting up timestamps so that future clips are viewed by everybody. So, I had a question, but you know what? We're going to go on to another call real quick because I've got Pedro in Ireland who is certain that he has enough evidence to demonstrate that God exists. So how you doing, Pedro?
Oh, good.
Hey, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
What do you got evidence-wise?
Right. So let's approach this carefully now. I've met your show like a couple of weeks ago. I haven't seen many of the videos. I've listened to the last three or four calls now. So I'm not sure if what I'm going to say has been discussed before, but it seems...
Well, I've been doing this for 17 and a half years, and I'm willing to bet every dollar in my wallet that I've addressed it at least 10 times. But go, because it might be new.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Like, every time I discuss this subject, I feel that we are putting terms in wrong places, because the matter for me is that God is more like... an evidence in the Latin sense, which is it's something that's undeniable. So it's a problem itself, then something that you believe in or not. So my problem is, how can I deny God? And then you come with the opposite, which is like, how can I even start believing this? So the first question for us just to start is what's the definition of God for you then?
It doesn't matter. And I promise I'm trying to avoid it. There's a normative classical definition of God, which is that there's a thinking agent that is responsible for creating everything. And then there's, you know, discussions about how powerful it is or how good it is or anything else. None of that matters, because what matters is, what God are you talking about? Because you might have a different God. For example, the person who called in earlier had a God that they thought was, you know, gratitude and all these other things. So you define the God that you believe in, and then we can tell you whether or not we're convinced that that God exists. But I can tell you that all the normative gods, all the ones that, you know, are identified as a foundation for Christianity or anything like that, I don't believe that any of those exist. So what's your definition of God?
So that's the thing. I don't believe in the literal religious gods, but I'd say every religion, they vent out, and the only possible definition of God, which if you go into, you mentioned epistemology, and if you go into the origins of epistemology, you have ontology, back with the Greeks, and even other religions before that, they vent out to this thing, which is God as the necessary unity. So for me, God is the ultimate concept. It is the necessary simplicity and the necessary whole of everything. And then from this very simple principle, which is also the first principle of logic, which is the principle of identity, which is everything is. So the being, just being itself, which is common for every single thing in the universe, which is be. From this point of simplicity, we can then make a different assertions. If it's intelligent, if it's good, if you have to be grateful, if it creates the world, all of these things unfold from this principle. And then
I'm confused though, Pedro.
It Go on, sorry.
I'm confused, though, because you're talking about, you're defining a God, and you're starting with definitions that are like, God is the necessary unity. Well, I don't know that there is a necessary unity. God is the necessary simplicity. I don't know that there is a necessary simplicity. But the following from that is that you also claim that God is undeniable. Is your God a thinking being?
That's complicated. I wouldn't jump in there before making the first definition.
Okay, I can tell you this, Pedro, and I don't mean this to be rude. I have zero interest. I have zero interest in people who have defined gods as abstractions. You may believe in a god. It's like the person earlier who said that their god was gratitude and stuff. Okay, cool, cool story, bro. Fire up a bong. Because when you say that you don't know whether or not the god you believe in is a thinking agent or not, you are now in a category that you're not Christian, Catholic, Protestant, you are not Hindu, you know, you don't qualify as any of these things. And it's fine. You may be right about what there is. I just don't know what the justification for saying that something that you don't even know if it's a thinking agent qualifies as a god, because that's outside the classical definitions. I appreciate the fact that it's still yours. I have no way of saying that your god doesn't exist.
It's Parmenides' definition from Greece, which is the ontology, which is the foundation of...
No. I'm sorry, Pedro, but definitions are not ontology. Ontology gets to what something is. Definitions are how we describe it. So it doesn't matter. You can go back to ancient Greek definitions of God or whatever else. That's irrelevant. That is trying to be descriptive, prescriptive with language to say that, oh, God must mean this. No, God can mean any number of things. And if you have a God that is just an abstract concept, cool, I have no interest in it. But if you have a God that you think is a being with desires, I have an interest in that.
So that's the thing. It is a being, but that's the point. When we say being, for example, let's take science for example, so we can have concrete evidence. If you see a cat and then you see the specimen in front of you and you decide, well, it's a feline, so it has a certain species and it belongs to a certain genus. And then you have this biological categorization, which is taxonomy, which is, each animal belongs to a species, then belongs to a category, then belongs to a family, to a kingdom, to a domain. And then there is groups that go enlarging it and different sets of beings go in different categories. But then you have categories above of them that encompasses all of them.
I'm going to rein you back in, Pedro, because I find this to be a completely irrelevant distraction. I asked you if the God was a thinking agent, and you said that's complicated, but then you asserted that the God was a being. How could you have a being that is not a thinking agent? I understand that there could be being, like existence, but how could you have a being that isn't a thinking agent?
Well, so that's the perfect answer for me as well, because...
That's not a perfect answer. That's the question. The question is never the perfect answer.
No, I understand. Just I would tap into this question to show that for me, God is in fact intelligent, because me as a being of intelligence...
Then why? No. Then why did, when I asked if your God was intelligent, did you duck?
Because I don't want you to see this from a mundane perspective of different gods and different perspectives of gods, when we have to start with the necessary simplicity, which is something is, and this is the unity of everything. So that's...
So I don't know what the unity of everything is. Andrew, do you want to...
This sounds like... I was trying to think of Daniel Dennett's word for it, and this is just deepity after deepity is what it is. I mean, it's the fact that we exist, I think, is what Pedro is trying to boil God down to. The other thing that keeps running through my head is Tim Minchin's 9-minute beat poem, Storm.
Storm.
Pedro, I am less than convinced about anything you are saying or the coherence of what you are attempting to say.
I really like, before we end this or get all the distractions, I'd like to see if maybe we can get one single point of clarity between us. What do you mean, Pedro, by necessary unity? Let's just start with that. I was going to say necessary unity or simplicity, but what do you mean by necessary unity?
Right. So that's the thing. If you see any object in the world, they are different in absolute. They are absolutely different from each other. So there's not in the entire universe a single object that's equal to another. So there's a multiplicity, and we live in the multiplicity. So that's science, and we use logic to move through this multiplicity. That's fine, correct?
Well, I don't necessarily know that. Yes, we can use logical reasoning to move through that multiplicity. Just like I have a dollar and another dollar, one could argue that there's a context in which they're the same, but they are definitely different and distinct, and we can reason about them. Yes. What does that have to do with necessary unity?
Because when we say the $2 bills are the same, we are equiparating them in a category, which is money. And then we can say also that dollars and euros are also money. And then you can see there is different categories that goes into encompassing more and more differences.
I don't understand what this has to do with necessary unity. I have two $1 bills in my wallet. There is a context in which it would be fair to say that they are the same, provided we define same as equal in value. But to say that they are the same with regard to logical identity is never true. Never, ever, 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 ever true. They are two distinct things. That's what the law of identity is. How does that relate to necessary unity?
Because at the same time, they are different and, as I said, perfectly not comparable in any way possible. At the same time, they...
No. As soon as you say they're not comparable in any way possible, you're just wrong. You can compare anything to anything in some fashion. What I'm saying is, yes, we have two $1 bills. They are distinct from the standpoint of logical identity. What does this have to do, for the last time, with necessary unity?
Because you have the structure of reality, which is multiplicity in one side and the unity on the other. But this distinction is just for us to understand it.
What is unity that you're... I'm not trying to be difficult, Pedro, but we're wasting a bunch of time here. For the final time, define necessary unity.
Is the unity of being. Everything.
That is a nonsense statement, that you can't define something by saying necessary unity is the unity of being. That doesn't edify anyone. It doesn't explain anything. It is absolutely a waste of words.
If you go into geometry, the point, how do you define the point? It has no dimension, it has no time, it has no space, it's just the point.
Pedro, what the hell does that have to do with, are you going to define, I tell you what, this is the absolute last chance. I want you to define necessary unity. Please explain the concept in a sentence or two in such a way that everybody here will understand what the hell you're talking about. That's it. That's all I can do.
It's just because I'm speaking about something that it's Greek philosophy, to be honest. So it's a subject that it's known in certain circles. But I found when you talk with atheists...
Goodbye, Pedro. I gave you 15 chances. And instead of actually defining it, you decided to do some meta thing explaining why you can't define it. Please think about it. Call back another time.
You know, Matt, so Pedro and Dustin are inadvertently proving like a big point that I'm trying to make in American Crusade, how the Supreme Court is weaponizing religious freedom. You know, one of the things that I'm trying to show in this book is that legal questions of religious freedom are not always simple, but really, they're actually pretty easy to answer. Most of the time when we think of them as complicated, they're just emotionally fraught. Crusaders have done a magnificent job of confusing us, but really the questions are, for the most part, like pretty easy to answer. And I lay out these three lines in the book about how we sift and sort through religious freedom questions. But I talk about in the book, I try to get people to think about religious freedom and the separation of church and state in different ways. And one of the ways I talk about it is as two different spheres of law. So one would be religious law and one civil law. So religious law would be voluntary and civil law would be mandatory. And, you know, a lot of these cases are at the intersection where there's this collision. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I try to explain to people is that believers have to find the courage of their conviction, right? They have to freely burden themselves when it comes to religious freedom. Civil law, we all have to follow. Religious law, people can adopt or not. The two systems are separate, but again, they're bound to collide. So if voluntary religious law can always exempt a person from the mandatory civil law, then that mandatory civil law ceases to exist and it's been replaced by religious law. And this is actually what the Crusaders are arguing for in most cases. And the Supreme Court actually looked at this back in 1878 and they said, to permit this would be to make the professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land, and in effect permit every citizen to become a law unto himself. Government could only exist in name under such circumstances. And I mean, like Pedro and Dustin are just like proving the point of that so clearly. Like, imagine them saying, well, I have a religious freedom right to not pay taxes or to not adhere to a civil rights statute. And why? Because gratitude says it, or because necessary singularity, whatever, says it, right? People can add rules for their personal behavior if they so desire, but they still have to follow that baseline, that civil law. If your religion demands more of you and that additional burden doesn't conflict with the law, you may do more. If your religion demands more of you and it does conflict with the law, you still have to follow the law.
Right.
And you know, as these two gentlemen are trying to describe what their personal religious beliefs are, I'm sitting there imagining them arguing this in court as a way to exempt themselves from mandatory civil laws in a way that conservative Christians and the Crusaders have successfully done over the last decade. And it's risible.
Yeah, there's a lot of different cases that have come up over the years. And I was so excited because I genuinely thought we were going to make more progress. But I'm not going to sit here and waste everybody's time going in circles over, I don't know what you mean by necessary unity, and you can't describe it. And when you dig in, and you're like, well, you can't, can you describe that? You're like, well, can you define a point in geometry? Well, it's an abstract identity of a location on a line. How do we define that? You might as well get down to the point where you're like, yes, but yes, you defined point, but can you define the letter P that you use to do the point? Let's get down further and further into this. The fact that something may not be robustly defined has nothing to do with whether something else is something that you can define. And all I was trying to do is find out, okay, if you say necessary unity, what the hell does that mean? And so think about it some more, come up with a way to package it, call us back. We're taking calls on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, Talk Heathen was on earlier today. There's been shows for weeks. And if you missed any of the things that have been happening on the shows in the ACA, boy, have I got something to show you.
Essentially, a bunch of white, cis, hetero dudes, most of them Christian evangelicals, planted their ideological and religious flags inside the uteruses of 2 million Oklahoma women.
But I also don't want to, like, support or encourage anyone else to help Matt Walsh profit off of this thing. If you feel like hate watching it and like to sail the seven seas, then that might be up your alley, if you catch my drift. Yar.
And speaking on this, Naughty mentioned it was an at-conception abortion ban. You wouldn't see these men proposing a pre-conception abortion ban. Because a pre-conception abortion ban would ban men from masturbating to climax.
And I don't have to constantly be shamed of my life and think that there's a God watching me masturbate. And I mean, that's a small example. But
that's what how you feel about things. That.
Like, if you're God, what do you plan to do? You're in Kentucky, it says. Are you going to you have a big plan? I mean, the end of the world coming? What's the next step for you/God?
And we're back, and we have Mark from Alabama, pronouns are he, him, with a possible explanation for the problem of divine hiddenness. So welcome, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. I want to get your view on this right here. I think I recall reading years ago, I think, probably from a guy you're not very popular or very fond of, Augustine, right? He postulated, I think, I'm going to have to confirm this, but I think he postulated that the problem of divine hiddenness stems from the fact that in our primordial history, human history, way back when, that our turning away from God, the original sin, whatever it was, so heinous, so bad, that he's just so disgusted with our ungratefulness that he just said, okay, the hell with you guys, you're on your own, I'll give you a couple of years to live, a decade maybe, after that, you're dead, that's it, man. That's, in plain English, that I believe is what he said. And I'm just wondering, what is your view on that? Is this like not even productive to the conversation? Probably not, I guess. So I just want to know, what is your view on that? Because I think this is brought up quite a bit about, you know, geez, he makes God plays the best game of hide and seek in the whole world,
yeah.
You know, which he does.
Yeah.
But I think, again, very quickly, I'm going to have to confirm that, but I believe that was Augustine's explanation for the problem of divine hiddenness, that we were such rotten.
Well, I don't care if it's Augustine or anybody else. That That is nothing but an ad hoc explanation for divine hiddenness. Maybe God decided to just piss off for a while. Well, cool. How do you tell the difference between a universe in which a God has decided to piss off for a while and a God which is otherwise hidden for whatever reason? That's the issue of divine hiddenness. It's not a response. When we say, why don't we see God or actions that we would think were God in the universe, you can't just say, well, maybe God doesn't want to. Well, thanks for giving me absolutely nothing. But
yeah.
Mark, I appreciate the call. I got to move on because we got audience calls from here, people live. But yeah, I'm not going to be impressed by any, maybe God did this. No, you have to make an actual case of it backed by evidence and everything else. So welcome. We have live audience here, and now we have questions from the audience.
Hi there. I'm Seth. I'm from Austin. I'm an atheist. I have a question in regards to separation of church and state in Texas. Recently, there's been the Senate Bill 797, which requires grade schools and educational institutions to display signs that show our nation's motto, In God We Trust. And it has some requirements on creative liberties that you can take for those signs. Some students have tried to combat this by donating certain signs with said creative freedoms being written in a different language, in Arabic, or written in LGBTQIA+ representative colors. There's been a court case recently in which these signs were refused under the excuse that the states or the schools had met their quota of these signs and they didn't need any more. How do you feel, or what do you think about this ruling given to combat these? As far as I can tell, there's no limit on the amount of signs.
So I'm gonna have Andrew chime in after I'm done with this, because I have countered this many times and people keep telling me, Matt, you're just wrong. So now that there's a lawyer here, I'm actually looking at the text of the law. It doesn't matter what Representative Hughes or anybody else wrote in a letter to clarify what they meant when they wrote the bill itself. His original intent doesn't matter with respect to what's codified there. But what it specifically says is that, and it's in two parts, a public elementary or secondary school or an institution of higher education as defined by Section 61.003 must display in a conspicuous place in each building of the school or institution a durable poster or framed copy of the United States national motto, comma, quote, In God We Trust, period, quote. If the poster or framed copy of message meets the requirements of subsection B and is, one, donated for display by the school or institution, two, purchased from private donations or made available in the school. That's where it has to come from. But with regard to what it can say, the language, the national motto, is in quotes there, In God We Trust, and I'm hearing somebody's secondary audio here, but a poster of the frame copy of the national motto must contain a representation of the United States flag centered under the national motto and a representation of the state flag, and number two, may not depict any words, images, or other information other than the representation listed in that subdivision, which, while it doesn't say it has to be in English, it has the U.S. national motto in quotes. And so it can only be those actual words, a U.S. flag and a Texas flag. You can't put a gay pride flag on it. You can't add your stars for your logo. You can't put donated by blah, 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 blah. None of that would be permissible, and neither would putting it in Arabic or Spanish or French or whatever else. What do you think of that assessment, Andrew? Am I wrong?
I don't think it was a court case. I didn't think there was a court case on this yet.
I haven't seen one yet.
I mean, and I am fairly certain I know what way a Texas state court judge would go. I think they would agree with Matt on this. That said, I am all for challenging this. I mean, look, this is Christian nationalism. And for those of you who don't know the history of In God We Trust, I tell that in my first book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. I mean, I think it's really important that we understand the history and that we call this out exactly for what it is. This is I wrote about this actually for Religion Dispatches. The same guy who proposed this law is one of the primary drivers of SB8. Right? This is an attempt to impose conservative Christianity on all of us. And this goes back to, I just want to say, all of the relics from Christian nationalism date to periods of American history where this country was times of great strife and division, 1950s, the Civil War. So, and In God We Trust really dates, at least on our coins, to the Civil War. It goes back to 1863. There was this preacher named Mark Watkinson, and he writes a letter to the Secretary of the Treasury, a guy named Salmon Chase, proposing godly language on American coins. He said something like, we need some recognition of Almighty God on our coin. And Watkinson didn't actually know Chase personally, but he begins his letter, you're probably a Christian. And I mean, Watkinson himself is a preacher. He wanted to remove the heathen, the goddess Liberty, and put on this new motto, which would relieve us of the ignominy of heathenism, was, I believe, how he put it. And so Chase took that suggestion from the preacher and sent it to James Pollock, who ran the Mint. And this guy was as kind of as Christian nationalist as they can come. He actually worked to alter the preamble of the U.S. Constitution from we the people, et cetera, to we the people recognizing the supremacy of Lord Jesus Christ, something along those lines. The whole point was to get Jesus Christ into the preamble of the Constitution. That was what he was shooting for. So they're talking about showing literally that the United States is, quote, a Christian nation. Right? I mean, this is the original form of Christian nationalism. The three men backdoor it, get it onto the coins without the rest of the country knowing. And then Congress is kind of left with this fait accompli, and they have to ratify it. And I don't know how familiar you are with the history, but 1863 is like the middle of the Civil War. The country is literally tearing itself apart. Brothers are killing brothers. Some of the bloodiest battles are fought then. And it was during that time when these three guys thought it propitious to get that money, to get that language on our money. So they took advantage of this time of national fear and crisis to impose their God on everyone. And this is what we have seen throughout American history when it comes to Christian nationalism, because the wave of Christian nationalism that we're facing right now is a new wave, but it's not the first wave. We've seen these previous waves, and each wave leaves behind artifacts, like In God We Trust, like One Nation Under God, like the National Day of Prayer, that the next generations of Christian nationalists can point to and say, see, we really are a Christian nation. And they validate their identity, which is based on lies and myths, using those artifacts from the previous waves of Christian nationalism. And if you're curious to learn a little bit more about that sort of cycle of validation, I submitted testimony to the January 6th committee, where I talked pretty extensively about that. And you can find that on my website, andrewlseidel.com, under the publications tab.
Awesome. We have more callers here. And by the way, before we get into this next caller, if you have questions and we can't answer them, there are other shows and there are other hosts right here on the Atheist Experience Network that you can call into. If you didn't like what I said or what Andrew said or whatever, there's other options. But we have Peter calling in from Canada, pronouns are he, him, who wants to talk about evidence for God from the geological column. So welcome, Peter. How are you?
Hey, how you doing there, guys?
Not bad.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, so I actually wanted to talk about the flood, Noah's flood. I think there's some good evidence for it. And I actually have one thing that I think is kind of the nail in the coffin that I don't think you're going to be able to refute, but I kind of just want to lay a little foundation, if that's okay.
Well, I'm curious because I'm really interested. And when you say that you've got something that I'm not going to be able to refute, you know what I can't refute? Unfalsifiable assertions. Nobody can, nobody has to. They don't stand on their own just because something that's not refuted. So you've got a burden of proof. It's not up to me to debunk it. You got to make a case.
Yeah, no, I'll make my case.
Cool.
Okay, so first of all, I wanted to just touch on the geological evidence. So they find there's a ton of geological, hours and hours I went through of it, of land animals mixed with sea creatures all over the planet on mountains. They found hundreds of jellyfish in pristine condition. Mount St. Helens eruptions. We watched fossils created in hours.
Mount St. Helens erupted in the 80s. Is that the eruption you're talking about?
Yep. That's where we saw fossils. You can go look it all up. We saw fossils created within hours. There's a mini Grand Canyon was carved from a mudslide within 9 hours. We have trees laid in volcanic rock, like a lot of our sites where we figure are millions of years old. The flood explains how fossil fuels were laid. The Russians dug an 8-mile hole. It's the deepest hole on Earth, and scientists were shocked to find water down there. The oxidization of the planet. So we know that there was 35% more oxygen on our planet one time. We know this basically because of the insects and the size that they grew to. The flood describes complete vegetation wipeout, which would explain perfectly how our oxidization went down, as well as the life lifespan of humans. We know from hyperbaric chambers that humans can rejuvenate, and actually our cells actually tend to go backwards. So, and then after the flood, the age started to decline. They estimate, I've done a lot of research on this, the scholars and the historians estimate the flood would have been somewhere between 4,500 to 7,000 years ago. And if you look at the pyramids in the Sphinx, 4,500 years old. The Sumerian, the oldest human script we have, Sumerians, 5,000 years old. Oldest mummified corpse we have, 5,000 years old. Oldest clothing item, 5,000 years old. The oldest holy site we found is 8,000 years old, but it was rapidly buried. And the nail in the coffin is the oldest tree on Earth, 5,000 years old. How do you explain the oldest tree on Earth is 5,000 years old from an evolutionary standpoint? They estimate trees to be 80,000 plus in age, and the oldest one we have on Earth is 5,000 years old.
Cool.
How do you refute that, Matt?
I don't need to refute it. You haven't demonstrated a single thing.
If you can't.
You haven't demonstrated a single thing. That. Nothing you said demonstrates the proof of a god or a flood.
No, it does a flood.
Not a global flood.
Aren't you an evolutionist?
Not a global flood. You know what refutes a global flood? Mathematics. There isn't enough water.
That's one of my favorite articles I've ever written, actually. I wrote that for Medium. How much water would be needed for Noah's flood to happen? It's 80 million. No, I can't even remember. I have to go look it up. It's insane. Also, do you know how we measure floods, Peter? With time, you know? It's a 10-year flood. It's a 100-year flood. That's because they are so frequent throughout human history. Every culture that we know of has flood stories because floods are a constant throughout human history. So the fact that other cultures, that every single one we know of mentions a flood at some point in their history does not indicate, as Matt is saying, that it is the same worldwide global flood. You understand that, right?
Yeah, all those stories, actually, you're leaving out, they all indicate a global flood. And these people were on opposite ends of the world at that.
Peter, they also didn't know what the globe was. For them, their world was their little geographic area, right? They didn't have satellites. They didn't know, you know, Asia and North America weren't in constant contact except when the land bridge was up. You understand that, correct?
Yeah, but you understand that they traveled, right? They weren't little people in a little isolated area. They traveled and discussed these things, right? They weren't little isolated populations. These people got around.
No, they were little isolated populations. But in any case, the Earth is about, 4.5 billion years old, and you think that it's a few thousand years old?
I never said that it's a few thousand. What I said is
I asked a question. Why are you so hostile? I let you talk and drone on with a whole bunch of shit that you clearly don't understand and don't know anything about for ages, and all I did was say the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and you think it's a few thousand years old? Question mark.
I never said it was a few thousand years old.
That's why I'm asking, how fucking old is the Earth in your opinion?
I don't know.
Good.
I don't think we can know. How could we know? Just because they say it's 14 billion years old, what does that mean?
No, the Earth is not 14 billion years old. It's 4.5 billion years old, and we know that because we've actually done science on it. So here's my question. If you don't know how old the Earth is, what difference does it make if the oldest tree is 4,500 years old?
Because trees don't stop growing, Matt. So if a tree is only 5,000 years old.
Trees stop growing. I've got dead trees. I've got dead trees in my yard right now. Why don't you come down and tell them that they don't stop growing?
See, you're contorting, though, right? You know
I'm not
exactly
contorting.
What you
mean. I'm not contorting. I'm pointing out flawed reasoning from you. I will mute you if you don't stop. But what I asked was, what difference does it make if you find a tree that's 4,500 years old? How does that demonstrate that there was a flood just prior to that? How does it demonstrate anything about a flood or the age of the Earth? How is that tree relevant?
Because that tree is dated to the exact period that a flood was supposedly said to have wiped out.
You're not listening. You are not listening. What does that tree's existence demonstrate?
It demonstrates either A, that the Earth is not nearly as old as you think it is, or B, that some catastrophe happened worldwide to extinguish all trees.
I'm sorry, but you're absolutely wrong. You don't understand what the existence of that tree demonstrates. What the existence of that tree demonstrates is that that tree exists. Nothing more. There needs to be more to say this tree exists and is the oldest because everything before it was wiped out by a global flood. You haven't made that case. You haven't provided evidence for that. You have haven't, and by the way, you just mentioned that it, which I'm sorry, but it's going to make you a big fat liar, is that you said it demonstrates that the Earth isn't as old as I think it is. You just said you don't know how old the Earth is. You weren't willing to say that it was thousands of years old. But when I push back on you to expose your fallacies, you trip up, and then you go on to say that the tree proves the Earth isn't as old as I say it is. Well, you're wrong, and when you go file the paperwork to get your Nobel Prize, I will be laughing.
I just pulled up my article, my old article too.
Yeah.
And my so this is back of the envelope math, but there's about 332 million cubic miles of water on Earth. That's what we have if you add all the water up on Earth. And the math for Noah's flood is 813 million cubic miles that you need. Just does not work out.
Yeah, I try not to dig into it, and I don't have it all memorized and everything else, but I will give everybody a resource, and it'd be a good resource for the previous caller as well. If you go to talkorigins.org, or just Google Index to Creationist Claims, you will find an exhaustive list of claims that real scientists have investigated, typed up responses to, provided links to evidence, shown how and why these things are not arguments for the claim. But at the end of the day, I mean, if you think about what just happened, here's somebody who calls in to say, there's this and this and this and this and this and this. It's very clear what happened. What happened is not this individual studied the science and learned what the science says about the age of the Earth and these things. All they did was listen to a creationist propaganda merchant to say this and this and this and this and this, which is why it's so easy to poke holes in this and why there's an entire website that exhaustively goes through these claims that they've been trudging out for years. Everything from how much dust there is on the moon. Just in the geology section alone, let me scroll up here a little bit. The questions that are there that get answered just on geology. Wow, I'm still scrolling just to get back to the beginning of it. It's too much. Go search. I don't need to read it to you. You can find the website. It's talkorigins.org. And if you think you have a defeater for the age of the Earth, if you think you have a massive amount of evidence that demonstrates that the Earth is young or that there was a global flood 6 to 10,000 years ago, do not call the Atheist Experience show. That is not how science is done, my friend. If you think you can debunk what actual scientists are saying about the age of the Earth in order to demonstrate the truth of the proposition that you are this special creation of a god that flooded and killed everybody in a monstrous act, every baby except for a family of eight, cool, you can do that. But don't call me. What happens if you convince me and Andrew? Hey, Andrew, now we're convinced that there was a global flood 10,000 years ago. Doesn't mean it's the one listed in the Bible. Doesn't mean that Yahweh is God. Doesn't mean that Jesus is Lord. It doesn't mean anything. A flood is an actual event that might have occurred at some point in history. We know of countless floods. Most of them are incredibly small regional, but as Andrew was pointing out, those people didn't know much about the world around them. When everything in your valley floods, that's the whole world to you. But if you've got something to prove, you better be coming with actual science and not just a bunch of stuff you read from creationists. You can take that stuff and go talk to the actual scientists. It's really easy. Well, assuming they'll talk to you. Some of them
get that Nobel
won't waste much time on it anymore. We have Patrick in New York with a question. How you doing, Patrick?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm all right. I figured I'd just let you read your question rather than reading it for you.
Oh, yeah. I said, how do you know that there is no God?
I don't.
Yeah, neither do I.
Well, I don't know that there's one either and stuff, but, you know, I had some answered prayers and, you know.
How do you know you had answered prayers? How do you know you had an answered prayer?
Because, like, it came out exactly for what I prayed for.
That doesn't mean anything. If I pray that this show ends at 6:32 and it happens, that doesn't mean it was answered prayer, right? You're basically saying you wanted something and it happened and therefore it was answered prayer. And I'm saying, okay, it's cool. There's lots of things I've wanted and wished for and prayed for, and some of them have happened. How do you know whether or not it happens as a result of coincidence or as a result of human action or the result of a God answering prayer? How do you tell the difference?
Well, because it was like the exact names of like...
It doesn't matter if it's exact. Like... It doesn't matter if it's exact. How do you know that it's answered prayer is what I'm asking. Are you saying that if anybody asks for something and exactly that happens, that that is always answered prayer?
Well, the Bible says so, like God
The Bible is irrelevant to my question, Patrick. Are you saying that if anybody prays for something and exactly that prayer happens, that it was always 100% answered prayer?
No.
Okay, so that means that there are sometimes when people pray for something and they get it exactly. Sometimes they pray for something and they don't get it exactly. But just take two people who prayed for something and got it exactly. How do you tell which one was answered prayer?
Well, I don't think, you can. But I think, the fact that I had, a couple that was, exactly on the spot made me, convinced that there's could be a God. But, I don't really think that there is, of the Bible's God because of the scientific errors and, problems in the Bible and no moral God would allow slavery. But,
yeah, I don't know how to answer this because it seems like you've just reversed your position. Because so if two people pray for something and they both get exactly what they prayed for, how do you tell which one was answered prayer and which one wasn't? And if you answered that, I believe, by saying you don't know how to tell which one's answered prayer. And so if you can't tell, how do you know that any of them are answered prayer?
Because it came out how I wanted it to.
I just asked the question that if it comes out exactly as you want it to, does that mean it's answered prayer? And you said no. And now you're saying that it was answered prayer because it came out like you wanted to. You are in a logically contradictory position. And I'm just going to move on, Patrick, but do some more thinking about it. Try and figure out how you can tell the difference between answered prayer and a coincidence or whatever else. Because, you've contradicted yourself already. And I don't know that that's going to do us much good trying to dig in further. Andrew, before we get to the last caller or two of the day, you and I we've known each other for years. We've done a bunch of shows together. I'm always excited whenever you're going to be on, but I'm also excited whenever I hear you've got a new book coming out. And I'm excited about this. We've talked a little bit about what they can do. Of course, look at the book and vote is the bare minimum that you can do. Participate. I want to try. Is there good news? Because after multiple years of dealing with politicians who are, let's just say, the exact opposite of pretty much everything I would want, and the Supreme Court being basically taken over by Christian dominionists to overturn Roe and target everything else. We've got the governor of Texas is targeting the family of trans kids if they're supportive at all. Every day, every election is the most important election in the world. Every debate and conference and January 6th hearing and everything is the most important it's ever been. And there's all this stuff going on. And all of it is about us and politics. We're not even focused on things like climate change, so we could fix this only to still lose the world anyway. Mm-hmm. Is there any good news?
I think there is. I sympathize and I certainly understand your frustration. And when you're fighting authoritarianism, every election is the most important. So let me start off. I want to say two things. First, the Crusaders are cowards. They lack the courage of their loudly professed religious conviction. The conservative American Christians' own religion tells them to expect trials and tribulations, not the government and the law bending to their every whim and fancy, right? Impending persecution, back me up here if I get the, or correct me if I'm wrong, rather, Matt. Impending persecution is one of the few points on which all four gospels agree. And American, especially the conservative Christians, they preach and they expect and they yearn for that persecution. You can see it in, the fabricated war on Christmas, the God's Not Dead movies, which, by the way, have financial ties to the Crusaders, the Left Behind books, Fox News, really feeds this persecution complex. And there's about half the country and three quarters of Republicans that think Christians in America face persecution. And white evangelicals are the only major religious group who say that Christians, the only major religious group where a majority of the group says that Christians face a lot of discrimination. And they even think that American Christians face more discrimination than Muslims in this country, which is simply not true. I'd be the first to stand beside them if that were true, but it's not. So first, conservative Christians in this country need to find the courage to bear the costs of their beliefs, especially when those beliefs are bigoted. And they can't do that. And their cowardice and their need for political power is actually feeding their demographic decline. And that demographic decline is what is feeding this crusade. There's this strange feedback loop that's coming. But that feedback loop is also feeding our side. Their wins in the abortion case, in the coach imposing his prayer on other people's children case, in the case of the main taxpayers who are forced to fund religious indoctrination at Christian schools, those wins swell our ranks. When a public school district in Louisiana tricks parents into sending its kids to a career fair so that it can proselytize the kids and split them into boys and girls and pick on any of the LGBTQ kids and tell the girls that they have to forgive their rapists. This happened last week in Louisiana. Americans United is already on it. They sent a letter. Right? They're creating this feedback loop. And the whole reason for this crusade, and I explain this at great length in the book, is demographics. The whole reason they are latching on and trying to weaponize the First Amendment is to codify their shrinking privilege, their once dominant status. They're raging against the dying of their privilege. So our opponents, white Christian nationalists, are working to privilege the chosen few. So every victory they have alienates more people. It wakes more people up to the danger and it drives more people into our arms. So their power-hungry aggression is growing our move. And there are other solutions to this, and I do get into some of them in the book. Again, none of them are quick and easy. I mean, this crusade was a long game. They captured the highest. Yeah, they captured the highest court in the land, and they are drunk on that power now. And right now, the Supreme Court remains just completely unchecked. So for us, I mean, it's going to be a long fight. We have to win a lot of hearts and a lot of minds. We have to do a lot of convincing. That is what American Crusade aims to do. That's what I'm doing every day at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and what we're going to be doing for at least the next 50 years, it looks like.
Yeah, I looked at it, and I know we talked about this before. I kind of teed one up because I love hearing your answer. There's that old adage of be careful what you wish for you might get it. And when you spend 50 years centering your ideology around overturning Roe, and you're dealing with people like me 10 years ago who thought this was impossible, this could never happen, and everybody gets kind of lackadaisical about things, now people are awake. So they've awakened the people who are like, oh, that could never happen. I mean, you know, the right wing's a little quirky about their religious beliefs, but they can't actually take away our rights. Yes, they can. They have. Congratulations. All of us were wrong for too long. Not all of us were wrong to the same degree and in the same way. But now that it's happened, what is their issue? What is their main issue? Where does their wedge issue that they drive in now that they've got, you know, oh, I know what it is. They're going to keep pushing on this, which is why you've got Lindsey Graham and others trying to flat out outlaw it, you know, across the board, or with he wants some exceptions. So he's pissed off his own party as well. Mm-hmm. On that note, I want to get to the last caller for today that has a question that I think we can handle fairly quickly. But Trent in Ohio has been waiting very patiently for all 2 hours. So thank you so much for waiting, Trent. We're going to take your question last. How are you, sir?
Thanks for taking my question. Hello to both of you.
Welcome. Hi, Trent.
So my question is it fair to consider death denial a major function of religion? And just a real quick background as to why I asked that question. I was raised a Christian and was a Christian for most of my life, up until age about 45. And I'm now 65, so that was 20 years ago I became an atheist. But one of the things that led to that, and as you can imagine, there were many, many things that led to that that change. But one of them was that facing death, or death itself, is an existential reality that causes many humans fear and anxiety. And of course, one of the solutions for that is some religious beliefs about an afterlife.
Right.
So whether that be heaven and hell or paradise or reincarnation. So I could see, I guess there's two sides of it. That caused me to reexamine the claims about Christianity and God more specifically, and I realized they just didn't hold up.
Yeah. I think the answer to your question, and you know, I guess we could have done this earlier, my answer is yes, that death denial is a major part of most religions. You can't say all of them because, you know, somebody's religion is gratitude. But for most normative religions that are dealing with the human condition, those that have built up a following, it is quite often about making people comfortable with their own mortality and providing a claim about an afterlife so that, you know, death isn't the end and your loved ones aren't gone and you'll meet them again someday and we'll all be there in the, you know, the family circle and we'll sing at the feet of Jesus and it'll all be wonderful. It is absolutely a fantasy that attempts to deny the harsh reality of mortality, and without absolutely echoing everything that Andrew said an hour and a half ago, it is the ending of life that gives it more meaning. That is where the value comes from. The fact that you might get a few years to maybe around a century, if you're lucky, to explore and learn and love and laugh, that is what makes it valuable. Do you want to laugh every minute for 5 billion years? Because in eternity, you could laugh for 5 billion years and then start doing something else for 5 billion years. It is absolutely a core aspect of this and one of the things that keeps people in it. Religions exploit our fears, and when they can't exploit the fears that we already have, like a fear of our own mortality, they invent additional fears so that they can be the only ones that provide the solution. It's not enough to be afraid of what happens after I die. Is there anything after this? No. They're going to come in and answer it. And their answer is, yes, there is absolutely something to be terrified of, because this place, you're just here for a short period of time, but your afterlife is forever. Well, hang on. Even with that fantasy, why wouldn't there be an afterlife for the afterlife for the afterlife for the afterlife? It is all about our fears, and they'll exploit everyone they can. And when they can't exploit the ones that exist satisfactorily, they will amplify those fears and they will add to them in many ways. So yeah, I think you're right on the money.
And I guess a further thought on that, and I agree, by the way, immensely that, you know, this life now is what we know we have. So it's quite an amazing gift to have that. But the follow-up question is, I personally have no belief in an afterlife, but I can't prove that there is not one.
Right.
So does this idea still hold up as a valid argument, and maybe that's too strong of a statement, but a valid argument against theism and religion?
No. The mere fact that they're exploiting our fear doesn't mean that they're wrong. You haven't falsified right. religion just because you're convinced, and I'm convinced, that they're making up a story for that. It's not enough on its own. If it was, we would have cracked this monster ages ago. But it is a good place to start, in much the same way that I'm not a big fan of the problem of evil as a response to certain religious doctrines. It is still a very useful place to start, and it led a lot of people, sometimes on its own, but along with other things in many cases, to give up their religious beliefs. So pointing out the problems in religion, there is no defeater, no absolute defeater, because the religions that we have now are the ones that manage to duck and dodge around all the other defeaters and wiggle through and make themselves just vague enough and just malleable enough that it's really hard to pin them down. They're slippery little fuckers. But on that note, Trent, I thank you for the call. I got to wrap this show up. Much thanks to you for your patience. Andrew, where can everybody see you?
Oh, I am Andrew L. Seidel on all the socials. I would very much love for people to pick up a copy of American Crusade, How the Supreme Court's Weaponizing Religious Freedom. It's out on Tuesday. If you want that signed copy, it's bit.ly/signedAC. And please, please, please join Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org. We're in the fight of our lives right now. We really need all the support we can get. So we'd very much like you to be a member and a donor.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come on here. I wish you all the luck with your book tour and book sales. I look forward to the next time we're in the same place. I know there's a handful of conventions that there's actually people starting to reach out for me for conventions next August. So I love when people are planning, you know, like a year.
Very exciting.
Time.
Yeah.
In the meantime, this program, The Atheist Experience, is one of many produced as part of the Atheist Experience Network by the Atheist Community of Austin. As I announced earlier, we are doing shows in the building on the last Sunday of the month. And in October, there's a special week starting with that Thursday to do Secular Sexuality, that Thursday, Truth Wanted, that Friday. I don't know what we're going to do in the gap on Saturday, but there's going to be people around, so we'll probably have some fun. We greatly appreciate everybody's support, all of you who are watching live. Please take care of yourself. Remember that while while our president has announced that the pandemic is over, there's still an epidemic going on and still caution to be exercised. Follow the guidelines in your health. Stay healthy and safe so that you can come down to Austin and visit us here at the building and that we can come visit you where you are, wherever Andrew's signing books. Until then, take care.
It's time to get sexy. So watch Secular Sexuality Live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central. Visit tiny.cc/YTSS and call into the show at 512-991-9242 or connect to the show online at tiny.cc/callsex.